This is Fergus O'Gorman, recorded at the Marguerite Bay reunion at Bowness on Windermere by Chris Alden Lee on the 30th of October 2010. Fergus O'Gorman.
Fergus O'Gorman, born in Dublin on the 26th of October 1934.
So how old are we now?
76, would you believe?
Where did it all go?
Where did it all go? Down the tube, mostly.
What sort of childhood did he have? Did he have a private education or a public education?
No, I was in estate school. Yeah, free education, in other words, you know.
What were your parents?
My father was a civil servant. My mother never worked, of course, once she got married. In fact, if women were working, when they got married, they had to leave in those days. Certainly, if you were in a state occupation, there were no married women allowed. In fact,
and what led you down the trail of biology?
Well, it all started, in fact, because I was interested in adventure and all that sort of jazz as a teenager, scouts and getting out in the woods and what have you. And I remember when I was probably about 15. My brother got a present from my father of E.R.G.R. Evans's book Southwood Scott, and it was a schoolboy version of it, and in due course it was passed on to me, and I read it, and I remember saying to my brother Brian, I said, "How do you become an explorer?" And he said, "You have to be a scientist." And I said, "What's that?" I did chemistry and maths in school, of course, but no biology in Ireland. The girls did botany.
Flowers.
That was perfectly reasonable for girls, but boys didn't do biology. But also girls did physiology, but my girlfriends at that age, you know, in the 16, 17, had a textbook in which the nuns had eliminated the bottom half of the human figure. This was physiology without the sex. You know.
Physiology with no phys.
Yes, exactly. So that's the way we were brought up. And in fact, it wasn't until, I wanted to do geology, which is the only sort of geography I'd done, with a bit of geology in school. And I said I'd do geology because explorers were geologists, you know. But when I got to college, the fact that animals jumped up and around and did things, and I was at that age when if it moved, you squeezed it. So I rapidly got interested in biology, particularly when the professor who brought in two copulating frogs to talk about sex. And most of us hadn't got a clue. No, outing. So zoology was far more interesting in that sense. And so I ended up, I did geology as a separate, a minor subject for my degree, but I ended up in a zoologist. But during that time, it was a 4-year course. I remember in second, third and fourth year, I applied to FIDS. Every time I saw an ad in Nature, I used to apply. It didn't matter what it was. Glaciologists, geophysicists, eventually. Of course, I never heard a word from them. But eventually, in my last year, I applied for a MET job. And I got a reply and I was invited to come for an interview. So that's where it all started. And in fact, Frank Elliott, who was a sec FIDS of those days, and you know Frank Elliott is still alive. He's 100.
Years old now, yes.
I'm hoping Keith will be here because I must write him a letter. Frank Elliott and Bill Sloman. I don't know whether you ever knew Bill Sloman.
I didn't know it, but he comes up an awful lot.
Yes, of course. But they interviewed me. I remember there were four people in front of me, and they all came out red-faced. And this, you know, I remember asking the last one when I was due to go in last, What was it like? He said, terrible. He said, you know, they were really stressed out, you know. Anyway, I went in for some fear and trepidation, and the interview was going on. And at one point, what I remember was that I was talking, Frank was asking me questions, and Bill jumped in and said, by the way, you are a Catholic, aren't you? And I went, yes. And he said, you know, most of these chaps will be Protestants. Will that be a problem? And I go, what do I say? And I said, I took a deep breath and said, some of my best French are Welsh. And Frank split his sides laughing. But when they got to the end of the interview, Bill said to me, by the way, we have a job for a biologist. Would you be interested? You know, and I said, do I jump up and throw my arms around him? No, probably that would not be the right thing to do. I said, yes. You know.
So was the interview strenuous? Because most of it say they were quite easy, really.
Well, I thought it was, other than that question, which sort of threw me, the interview was okay. I don't remember anything else stressful about it.
No.
I then had to go to the colonial office, to the medical officer, to be psychologically examined.
Really?
Yes. They said, oh, you have to make sure you're suitable, you see. So this pucker fella, who was wearing a tie with XVs all over it, and little Cambridge or a college insignia sort of thing. And after he'd gone through the bit about, you know, all the medical sort of stuff, he says, well, now we have to talk to you about your suitability. And I said to him, realising obviously he was a rugger, had played rugby, I said, were you at the Oxford and Cambridge match last weekend at Twickers? Which I had been. And he said, yes, were you? And we spent the time talking about the match. At the end, he said, you'll do fine. He said, that was the, obviously, if you played rugger, you were the right sort, you know. I had to have another interview, which was Francis Fraser, who was the discovery expedition in the 20s in South Georgia. He was the biologist and he was the whale man, and he was in the head of mammals in the Natural History Museum, in the BM. And so I had to go out and see him in the basement. He was surrounded by these giant skulls of all sorts, you know. And he said, he was a very nice little small Scotsman, and he said, I'm just making a cup of tea, would you be? And I said, we had tea and we talked, chatted around. And after about half an hour, I said, this is a very funny interview. There's no, you know, he said, I'm supposed to be interviewing for a job, haven't I? And I said, yes. He said, and he sort of scratched his head and he said, what does a leopard seal look like? And I said, long and snaky. He said, you'll do. And that was the end of it. I got no training, absolutely none. It was, when I came back to down south, I was a month in the office, trying to discover what sort of equipment I needed to read all the material left about seals, because I was going to be a seal biologist.
Did you know what a fur seal was?
Well, I'd heard of fur seals, of course, but I mean, I'd never seen one. and in fact, that was the time when Bunny was down south doing the TAE, and Raymond Priestley was running the office. Mm-hmm. And so Sir Raymond, and there was a whole clatter of Sloan Rangers also in the office, and me, you see. And in the afternoon, Sir Raymond used to come out and say, O'Gorman, tea and muffins, or whatever he had, biscuits or whatever. So every afternoon we had, he would reminisce about Scott and Shackleton and everybody. Unbelievably interesting stuff, you know. And he remember him saying to me when I was going, he said, no, when you come back, come down and see me in Tewkesbury. Of course, I never did, which I always regretted, you know.
Did you come across the redoubtable Ann Todd at this point?
Oh, absolutely. Ann Todd was in the office. And I had lunch with Anne about 3 weeks ago in Cambridge. lovely woman.
But we're trying to get her to do this.
She'd oh,
bit,
is she?
A bit shy.
Yes, that's right. She would be. But she must have immense memories of Fids and Bass, of course.
And Fuchs.
Oh, and Fuchs, of course.
Yeah. Oh, well, we're still, if you see her again, please try and...
Oh, yes, her, I will, yes. Yeah.
So you're still in touch with people like that?
Yes, absolutely.
Right. You ended up going on the RSS Shackleton, and there were, I think, 28 Fids altogether.
Yes, I think, there were 28.
And tell me about two of them in particular, because you went with Alan Sharman and Tink Bell, who
yes.
were fated, weren't they, sadly?
Yes, they both in 1959 died at Admiralty Bay. And I had just spent the best part of 3 months, well, not quite 3 months, in a tent with Alan on Livingston. And... we were taken off by chopper from Protector, and I was dropped in Deception, waiting for the Biscar to come up, and Alan was taken to Admiralty Bay, and within 3 weeks or what can't have been long, a month perhaps, he was dead.
How did he hear the news?
Over the radio, of course, which is the only communication we had, you know, in those days.
What are your memories of him? You camped with him for a while. What sort of guy was he?
Oh, he was a very nice fellow. He was a mad keen bird watcher, and that's why he was on the summer party with me, and had been at Cygni and done bird work and so on. And he had been in the RAF and had been... mountain rescue and all that sort of jazz. He was a very nice guy. Really, I went to see his parents when I came back,
which was
a very difficult. They were in Bedfordshire somewhere, and I went up to see them. Well, there was, and it's interesting. I mean, Tinker, I didn't know as well, obviously, but. It was very sad about them, really.
Did many Fids go and visit Alan's parents?
I have no idea who.
Was it something you chose to do off your own?
Oh back? Yes, absolutely. Yeah. I just felt I needed. No, I felt I needed to. You know, because I had spent so much time with them. Largely, I mean, essentially, the last time he was in the field, basically. And it's interesting that there is a book called The Crystal Desert. Written by an American biologist about biology in the on the peninsula, came out well in the 90s or the early, you know, at the end of the 90s. That's sort of a very nice book, and he describes going into Admiralty Bay, and going up to the graves, and he prints out what it says on the graves. And I got stuck there. I couldn't read the book. I've only just recently reread it, in fact. That's 10 years. I just couldn't pass that point, in fact. I was amazed, you know, that so much, there would be so much emotion after that length of time, you know.
Well, it's someone you didn't know for very long, and the death was... 50 years ago.
Yeah. Well, I knew him all the way through, you know, because we'd been in contact. I mean, you know, on the network, I'd gone down south with him. He'd gone into Cygni. I should have been gone back to Cygni, but I didn't because of the Shackleton crash. But we were on the same wavelength. We did all the bird obs on the boat together, you know, that sort of thing. So we got on very well, in fact. I liked Alan a lot.
Shackleton had quite a bit of trouble, didn't he? That's
oh, it. Stop. Well, I mean, on the way out, we had Asian flu, which meant that the whole crew, aside from a few of the officers, were all laid up. And we had, and
the ship crew?
Yes, and the Fids had to do all the work, you know, even steering the ship, in fact, and everything else, stoking and so on, and in the heat, wow. But anyway, not only that, but then the engine broke down or something went wrong, and we were it it took us the best part of a month to get to Montevideo. Then we had to hang around where they flew out the new part. So we were 10 days in Montevideo, you know, which was an interesting experience.
dare I press you on anything there?
Well, I mean, as you can imagine, coming from my sort of background, which was...
reserved.
No, yes, I mean, unexposed to anything, basically, you know. And my mother, if you said bloody, she'd thump you around the ear, you know. There was no bad language allowed in the house or anything like that. And you get dumped with a lot of lads who've been in the services, you know, just under their compulsory couple of years. And the language now, I mean... I found it astonishing, but of course I rapidly caught up, you know. You learn some things that you never heard about, so anyway. And then, of course, when we got to Monte, I learned something else, because John Graham, who was the medic, and one of the medics on board, gave us a lecture about venereal disease, which I hadn't, even though I was a biologist, I knew nothing about venereal disease. It was news to me, you know. So we all went ashore, and I mean, I can't have been the first night, but we ended up in a place called the Cubilete, which was a notorious knocking shop in Montevideo, which was an experience which I couldn't possibly cope with. You know, this girl came and sat on my knee and put her arm around, and there was music and whatever. And I think after half an hour, I got up and ran out the door. You know, I couldn't cope with this. But however, you learn from these sorts of experiences.
Who was the captain of the ship?
Norman Brown, who hammered the ship into the dock at Stanley. And then finally, when we were to be, just after the summer party I was on Powell Island, was landed in the Lutherwaite Strait, he hammered a piece of ice and practically sank the ship. They were up to their tonsils. Very lucky that the protector was around. And two of the, I don't know whether they were able seamen or whether they were officers, I can't remember now, but went over the side and pinned a tarpaulin or something over the hole. And both won Albert medals, in fact, if my memory serves me right, which must have been a horrendous experience.
Didn't you get some sort of notoriety for that incident as well?
Oh, well, only in Ireland. I mean, my mother, I remember her telling me that she opened the door to a knock Friday or Saturday evening, I can't remember, and there were sort of flash bulbs going off, and they said, "Have you heard from your son?" And she nearly fainted on the spot, you know. Because Fids didn't know whether we were on the boat or not, and put out a list of names, you know, of which, so that in fact the major Sunday paper in Ireland had Irishman in Antarctic drama about two, you know, double columns across the top of it. And I wasn't there at all.
Because you went on the boat?
No. We'd been dropped off about 4 or 5 hours earlier, and we were setting up camp at that stage on Powell Island.
Let's just talk a bit about Stanley, because you went through Stanley, obviously.
Well, I went through Stanley. I went through Stanley on the way, and then came back to it because of the Bisco came and pulled us off Powell Island, much to my regret.
Well, let's come back to that in a moment. What was Stanley like when you first arrived as a first-time fit in Stanley?
My impression of Stanley was that it was a one-horse town. I mean, one street town, practically, you know.
Was it... So it was no more advanced than towns in Ireland, or backward compared to Ireland?
Oh, yes. Much more backward. I mean, tin houses, you know, tin roofs everywhere, that sort of stuff. It looked very primitive, in fact, and there was only one pub, and there was a church, of course. But lots of social activity, because once the ships came in, everybody descended on everybody, you know, and we had a great time, in fact.
So you were chatting up local girls, were you?
Oh, yes, yeah. Not only that, but as much to my amazement, I got invited by the governor to go and have dinner with him, myself and Jim Shurcliffe. Do you know Jim?
I do, yeah.
Yeah, Jim and the two of us. I don't know why we were, but anyway, he had two beautiful daughters, Arrowsmith, a very nice man. His wife was Irish, though she didn't like to pretend that she was had any Irish connections, but however, in those days. But we had these lovely girls, I remember. Anyway, so that was an interesting episode.
So you headed on in that first season, we're talking about
57. That was 57.
You were heading off to South Georgia, and you came face to face with the whaling industry.
Oh, yeah. Unbelievable smell, you know, that's which the minute you got there, it just sort of enveloped you, the smell, and the butchery and the whole. I, of course, spent subsequently nearly 3 months in South Georgia, so I saw it in detail, but whaling, of course, the whole setup there was dry. There was no alcohol allowed. And I remember probably the first night we were there, and I was a teetotal. I didn't drink at all, in fact, in those days. I remember coming down the gangplank, and there was a very nice young Norwegian, blonde-haired Norwegian, and asking me, could I... could he get a bottle of whiskey, you know? And I said, bottle of whiskey? He said, I'll give you a sweater. I don't need sweaters, he said. And he said, I'll give you a pair of skis. And I said, a pair of skis? He said, yes, I'll be back in a minute. Anyway, he disappeared, came back with these 7 foot, you know, the original wooden skis, you see. And I said, well, no, that's a different matter. I went and got a bottle, which costs negligible. I think it was a shilling or something. Very, very small amount of money, anyway. And I gave him the bottle, and I still have the skis, in fact.
Did you use them much?
Yes, I did, yeah. But not much, because, in fact, the shorter skis were coming into vogue then, and Fitz had supplied shorter skis for field work, you know, so...
There's a reference to you meeting Dick Barton now. Do you actually meet Dick
yes,
Barton?
I do, yes, yeah.
Is that Duncan Carst?
Duncan Carst, yes, yeah. He came along, again, everybody else was, I don't know whether, I was probably shortly after I met this young lad, because somebody turned up on the dock, and I said hello to him, and I said, who might you be, sort of thing, and he said, Duncan Carst, and I said, Dick Barton? And he said, yes, you know. He was doing the survey, of course, in South Georgia, and he was living in the jail. But he was well-oiled, I might add, which apparently was par for the course. I had a short conversation with him, and I think I left it at that, you know.
So anyway, you were on Powell Island there. The idea was you were going to be there all summer, I think, weren't you?
Yes, that's right. We went. I was to go into Sydney. I knew nothing. I arrived in Sydney and to be told that the following morning we were leaving for Powell Island. So I had to go and sort all myself out, you know, gear and everything else. And we went down to Powell Island and got dropped off there.
And suddenly biology had to start being done, didn't it?
Yes, suddenly you suddenly it's there in front of you. You know, what do you do? Well, I had to learn to ski. I'd never been on skis. And Cecil Scotland, who was the base commander and also the leader of the Powell Island group, said to me, "No, just put those skis on, clamp them in. And I said, "What do you do next?" He says, "You just go down the hill." I said, "Go down the hill?" He said, "Yes." And he pushed me, and I shot down the hill, ending up in a heap on the ground, of course. That's your first lesson, he said. That was the only lesson I ever had about that. But you have to learn a whole business of, you know, survival, camping, in the Antarctic. And man-hauling, oh, God, when I think about it. and the biology. I shot a seal. We were going to eat it as well as Richard, and I wanted to get some experience about it was a Weddell seal, and when I opened it up, I said, "My God, what is different? I mean, this is supposed to be a mammal. It doesn't look like anything I knew. I'd only ever dissected a rabbit before that, you know." And because seals have an enormous vein down the middle in which they retain all the blood coming back from the muscles, mm-hmm. and it's clamped off so that it doesn't flow back, you know, it has to stay. And so that you have a vein that's probably 4 inches across, running right up the middle of the body. And you say, "My God, what is that?" You know. Anyway, it was all news to me. The whole thing was news to me.
Why were you dissecting it? What were you looking for?
Well, I was trying to get experience about it, because we were interested in the reproductive physiology of us, you know. And I was exploring, basically, how do seals function, while I was reading in papers and things, you know.
So it was to educate you rather than educate other
people. Yes, yeah, but we were going to eat it anyway. So, right. I mean, you know, and we ate everything. I mean, penguins. We shot everything. We ate penguins. I remember eating this. I was collecting black-bellied storm petrels for the British Museum, and they're tiny, tiny little seabirds. One of the smallest ones in the world. And having skinned it, I said, "Now, we have to eat it, because that's the right thing to do, you know, otherwise." I peeled off the breasts and put them on a matchstick and singed them over the primus, you know, that sort of thing. So it wasn't anything I hadn't tried to eat, in fact. In the end. And of course, we eat no fresh food, you see. So it was important that you ate.
You were actually pulled off Powell Island rather unexpectedly, weren't you?
Yes.
What's the story behind that?
Well, that's, of course, once Shackleton was rescued and went to South Georgia and was laid up there, then they had to reroute all the ships, and the Biscoe came along 3 weeks later, in fact. And
so it was logistics that pulled you off?
Yes, exactly. Yeah. I presume, I mean, they could have come back 2 months later, but anyway, the powers that be said no, take them off. And anyway, we were totally unaware until the ship arrived on the doorstep, you know, even though we had a radio of sorts. Excuse me. And Cecil said to me, "We're going to be pulled off." And I said, "Tell him to F off. I'm staying here for 3 months. I want to stay here for 3 months." And he said, "You can tell them yourself." So I got out the... And Tom Flack came up on the air, and I said, "We're not leaving. Sorry." I politely said, and he said, "We will send some chaps to help you pack." And these three burly seamen arrived. You know? And Cecil says, "I think we better go." You know? And we did. And I ended up, but they went back to Sydney.
Well, did they know what to do with you next?
Well, that was the whole point. They didn't. Yeah. The Shackleton had, when we were in Montevideo, the Professor Craig from Newcastle and Lou Chanter from the Daily Telegraph came on board, and they were in fact on board when they crashed. But he was there to set up a biological program for FIDS, and he rapidly realised, you know, I had no positive training and what have you. So there was, I've read the files, you see, since subsequently, there was a row going on between the governor, the one head, who felt I should stay in the Falklands and do something about the seal industry there, for seals there. Cambridge, not wasn't Cambridge in those days, but Sir Raymond, who felt... that and the governor felt that really they didn't want somebody from the north of England running the biology program, and Cambridge was around, you know, being Cambridge chappies.
So they didn't want you back in Cambridge?
Well, no, they didn't want him to be running the program.
Oh, right.
And he then recommended that I should go to Montevideo to the the professor who ran the sealing research in didn't run the industry, but there was a fur seal industry in off Punta del Este, and that I should spend the winter there. That would be much more productive. So that's what I did, in fact.
You spent that winter, 57-58, yes, in Montevideo?
Yes, the only FID ever to have wintered in Montevideo at Her Majesty's expense.
How long were you there then?
I went up on the Protector when she was going home, and there was a big... I stayed on the Protector while she was in port, and we had... I met everybody in innumerable parties, as one does on these occasions. So that would have been April. I went down back to South Georgia late August when the sealers were going from Buenos Aires to start the sealing industry, and it was that winter.
Did you know you were going to go south again when the spring came?
Yes, that they said yes.
That was all part of the plan.
Oh yeah, of course, because I mean I had I still had 2 years to go, you know. And that's what happened. Of course, I broke my jaw playing rugby. the week before the South American Champions, I would have got an international for Uruguay. Yes.
Well, that led to some sort of restriction, didn't it?
Oh, yes, of course. That was a rather expensive exercise. Very good for my figure, though. I lost about a stone in the process. FIDS said... sent around a thing saying no more FIDs playing rugby anywhere. So it was banned. You could play soccer, but you couldn't play rugby.
So when did you head back south again?
Well then, in August, I went to Buenos Aires and the gear which I'd had, which had come out to Montevideo to pursue me sort of thing, I had to go on board the ship, and the McLean and Stapleton, who were the Crown agents, had to bribe the guy to let the gear on without opening it. These were crates, you know, with scientific equipment in. And I remember asking him afterwards how much. He said £100, which was no small amount in those days.
Why did the gear have to get on without being looked at?
Well, because they wrecked the bloody thing. They were only doing it for the bribe, you know. They came along with three fellas with large hooks and, you know.
Crowbars.
Yes, and a discussion which had gone on for 2 hours or more, you know. Anyway, we got to South Georgia, and that was the... being used as the acting sealing inspector, because Nigel Bonner, who was the sealing inspector, his wife Jenny was having a baby, and Nigel stayed in the UK and came down with the ships. So he arrived and I transferred onto the Biscarro and went south.
Was Fuchs in Monty with you at some point?
Not at all. I never saw Bunny, in fact, until I came back to London to work up my results afterwards. He was then running the office.
So you're heading back south again. You're ending up on South Georgia. And again, you came face to face with the whole whaling business, didn't you?
Yes, the whole whaling business and the... the whaling business was in decline, as you can imagine, and they went out of business in the mid-60s completely. By 62 or 63, it wasn't worth the time. The Japanese tried for a couple of years and gave up, but all the Norwegians and Pesca, which you know had been there since 1904, gave up as well. No, it was a disaster in that respect. The elephant seal industry in South Georgia was quite productive and, in fact, was well regulated. Dick Laws had been involved in doing the original regulations, you know, as to how many they should take, etc. And that worked. And it was it used to be an important element because they provided probably 50% of the oil that the whales did, you know. So it was a fairly lucrative part of the activity.
Was the whaling industry not quite so well policed then?
No, at every turn. I mean, I wasn't involved, but I used to, well, if I wasn't at sea, I was hanging around because there was nothing else to do, of course. And it used to, the immature or female whales were off, not offshore, but they weren't on the plan, which is where but as soon as the inspector went for his lunch or anything else, there was an immediate whistle, and they whistled up these whales and chopped them up before anybody. So I took photographs of pregnant females and with feces and what have you out on the plan, which of course were prohibited, you know. But they were killing anything they could get at that stage.
Which countries were these? Which nations?
Oh no! I mean the company in Grytvik is Pesca was an Argentine company, but run by the Norwegians. I mean, all the whaling was run by the Norwegians. Oh, the operational thing were all Norwegians. They held it very tight in, you know, Stromness, Husvik, the whole lot of them. I mean, probably 90% of the workers were Norwegian, and the managers and everything else. And the gunners, of course, the important people.
And they were flouting the regulations?
Yes, yeah. They were saying, kill us. If it's there, just take us. And they were doing that. And of course, the population was going down the tube very rapidly. Yeah. I did.
And was that because the industry was dying? Do you think they were just a sort of final kick?
Yes, yes. I think probably in the late 50s, that's what it was. But whether they behaved otherwise remains to be seen. I don't. I think you, in the 60s and 70s, I mean, I know the Southern Ocean fishery was in fact being exploited outrageously by the Russians and the Japanese, because they exchanged inspectors, and they made up the figures, and they've admitted it since, you know. So I mean, when there's money involved, it's all about greed, of course, you know.
So where was your second winter then spent? If the first one was spent in the flesh pots of Montevideo, the second one was somewhere else.
Yes. I went from South Georgia back to Stanley, and then down to Livingston for the summer. That's where Alan and Pete Hodgkinson, who was the base commander in Deception, the three of us spent that period looking for furses, because the survey on Livingston had been the previous year, and they had seen quite a lot of individual fur seals. I mean, a lot, like 20 or 30 sort of thing, you know.
Was this when the fur seal was beginning to make its comeback, or was this?
Yes, well, you see, in South Georgia, at that point in time, when I was there, there were probably anything up to 15,000 fur seals on Bird Island. And so they were obviously coming back. And then the immature males were scattered, and they used to turn up on Cygni and all around, you know, in the South Shetlands and so on. So the survey party, which had been doing Livingston the previous year, decided that there was a potential fur seal population in on Livingston, and we were landed there to pursue it. And in fact, I fell over the first pup that was ever found in the Antarctic. I was walking along this beach and I stumbled over what I presumed was a rock, and the rock reared up and went, sort of. It was a baby fur seal, about 10 inches high, you know. And that was the first one, probably for a century, that had been recorded, you know, in south of the...
On Livingston Island?
Yes, but south of the Antarctic... Not the circle, but I mean, what was to be the Antarctic region, a la the treaty, south of 60, in other words, you know.
What did you do with it?
Well, I just... We spent 10 days, looking at it, and then searching the area in the hope that we might find more along that coast. And in fact, there are now 5,000 females on that beach. Would you believe? That's the current estimate.
So it's gone from 1 to 5,000
yeah.
in 50
yeah.
years.
Yeah. But then the population has gone in the. I was down in 2006 in South Georgia, and they were saying 3.5 million, and the most recent estimate is 6 million for us. It's on South Georgia alone.
As somebody who studied them, can you understand why they've suddenly made this?
Well, of course, yes, because in fact, what happened was that when you wiped out the whale population, there was all this food. You know. So, I mean, the seals had a bonanza. I mean, unlimited amount of food. And when we went down to Stonington and got in there in 2005, all the way along the Western Peninsula, there were beaches, whereas when in my day, and there was never a beach. There was all ice cliffs, you know. Yeah, you have to climb up the ice to get ashore, in fact, always.
So their breeding grounds are...
No, but so it's somewhere that it can land, in other words. And in fact, at 68 South, there was bloody... We went into Stonington and Horseshoe, and there were fur seals on the beach. I said, no! You know, no, they weren't breeding. These are male, dispersed, young animals, you know, dispersion. But unbelievable. Very successful. In that sense,
You did some man-hauling, didn't you, at one point?
Yes. Well, I had very little man-hauling on Powerline, but I had enough that I knew I didn't like it. but on Livingston, we had to man-haul, and God, and I was completely, having been in the flesh pots and whatever, I was completely unfit in that sense, and the Alan and Pete put a winter behind them, you know, and they were really fit. And I was, did I struggle? And quite a lot of the time I had to rope on behind just to keep, you know, I couldn't cope. But that was some of my worst days, I can tell you.
How were your navigational skills?
Well, no, we didn't have a problem with navigation most of the time, though our first forays from the base camp heading west, we ran into a blizzard, and of course we couldn't see where we were. There was a white out, and I said to Pete, you better check the compass. And he says, what compass? And I said, compass. He says, you're the leader, you're supposed to have the compass. And of course I didn't, you know. So we wandered around for hours. I'm really getting worried. And you know, this thing, you're supposed to, if you keep on turning right, you know which the way the wind is blowing, it's sort of rubbish. But we ended up on the coast and had to work our way back along the coast. That was one long day, I can tell you. I remembered the next time, I can tell you, to have a compass.
Yes. Again, the helicopter came to get you. Rather, yes. You seem to have bad luck with helicopters.
Yes, that's right. Not only that, but I had Pete, who got snow blindness, of all things, which held us up for 10 days. But however, the helicopter arrived saying, we are taking you off. Why, I never discovered. But the amusing thing was that when we were helicoptered onto the protector, the first officer said... the captain wants to see you looking at me, you see.
Had you been doing something wrong? Were you in the wrong place or anything?
Oh, no. We were running a survey. I mean, we still had the eastern part of the island to cover.
Yeah.
And we never got there, in fact. Because we didn't have dogs, because the previous Hope Bay people who had been there said, oh, absolutely not necessary. You know, you can man-haul anywhere. Yes, if you want to man-haul 30 miles from you know. But anyway, I was dragged up to Captain Butler, who was a big, burly naval officer, and he had a tiny little admiral with him, who was the first admiral of the South Atlantic Fleet, apparently. Very nice man, but I mean, I don't remember his name. And they offered me a drink, but I didn't drink, you see. Of course, the other two lads, being officers, weren't invited at all. You know, good Navy tradition, you only speak to officers. You know? Officers only speak to officers. But after about, I don't know, 10 minutes, or perhaps a bit longer, I remember Captain Butler goes over and rings a bell, and the first officer comes in and says, take O'Gorman down and give him a bath. You do need a bath, don't you, O'Gorman? Now, we hadn't washed, of course, for the 3 months we were there. And I can imagine this, man, because I had been dissecting animals, and I was covered in blood and grease and every other damn thing from living in a tent, of course. So I remember I had to have three changes of the water before I could see the bottom.
The Admiral was called Dimmock Watson.
Was it?
Yeah, Admiral yes. Dimmock Watson.
Oh, I didn't know that. Mm. Oh, that's interesting.
The little guy.
Yeah, little yeah, guy. Yeah, yeah. Yeah, very nice man.
So what did the protector do with you?
Well, he just dumped me on deception. And now, I think they may have dumped Alan on Admiralty Bay, because I don't remember that Alan was on deception at the same time. So I was there for about 3 weeks, I suspect, maybe even 4, waiting for the ship to do its final round and pick me up on the way out, you see. Mm. And I had I enjoyed deception because, of course, the Argies and the Chileans were there. And because I'd spent the winter in Montevideo, I was, my Spanish wasn't great, but at least I could communicate, you know. So we went to some very nice parties, which was a pleasant enough occasions, in fact. But anyway, I ended up then back at Signy for the winter and for the following summer, of course.
So you're back to fur sealing again at Signy, were you? What,
well, no, because there were no bloody fur seals in Signy. So, I mean, I was doing all the... I mean, there was a bird ringing program, a penguin study program. There were all of the giant petrels, which had been ringed about 3 or 4 years ago, were starting to turn up, and we realised that in fact they circumnavigated the Southern Ocean. Now nobody knew that, pardon?
That was your discovery.
No, no, not at all. No, it was probably Lance Tickell who had been a met man, and he had been part of this program. And when I was in the office, Lance in London, Lance had come along and said that they were running this program that they needed to, and they were starting to get returns from South Africa and Australia, and it looked like that. This is what was happening. So, and of course, that's what it proved to be. You know, that was quite exciting, in fact.
Yeah. It's a little discovery moment. Isn't it?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, there was a few of those moments, not many.
There's one word we seem to be missing from all this, and that's organisation. Now, one gets the impression that the Fids didn't seem to quite know what to do with you, Fergus.
No, they had no... Well, there was nobody in charge, because Craig, they had dumped Craig when he came back. In fact, I was told that as a result, he went to Canada, in fact. And so it wasn't for several years later that they had a biological programme and with any control over it. You know.
You weren't receiving signals from London telling you what to do?
Nothing. I never... I had no professional support whatsoever. I don't believe I ever had even one signal saying, you know, here's your programme sort of thing. I mean, there was an outline, this, do this, that and the other. But in fact, I got it because there was the Weddell seals, there was a very nice breeding population on Signy, but Arthur Mansfield had worked on them, and Dick Laws, of course, had done all the work on the elephant seals. And there were no fur seals. So I ended up getting involved in reproductive physiology, which I was quite interested in, and the whole question of delayed implantation, which was a very... how are we doing for time?
We're doing fine.
Okay. delayed implantation, which I'd never heard about because nobody talked about it. It didn't appear in textbooks in those days, you know. And suddenly you have an animal here, and all the species, in fact, who instead of implanting once they're pregnant, wait 3 or 4 months before, you know, so that they pop at the same time each year, but they don't have a 12-month pregnancy, a 9-month pregnancy or a 10-month pregnancy, depending on what. And the whole physiological mechanism is really interesting. And I spent a lot of time shooting seals and trying to recover the blastocysts, that they're called. Anyway, I got involved in the whole development of seals from, intrauterine development, you know.
So you were shooting seals in various stages?
Yes, trying to. Yeah, pregnancy. Exactly. And in fact, I even delivered a few. Yes.
You delivered a few seal pups?
Oh, yes, but their mothers had died from lead poisoning.
How did they get lead poisoning? Oh, right.
I shot them.
Right.
So, that was the day when that sort of thing, it sounds horrific now, but it was par for the course. We were shooting seals all the time for feeding the dogs. We ate them, and we were doing it for scientific reasons, and there was no objections, and it seemed to be quite a reasonable thing to do.
The survival of a pup whose mother's just been shot is nil, isn't it, because there's no milk?
Well, the one I delivered, the one that was full term I delivered, I tried to feed it myself. We kept it for about 3 weeks in the lab, and it was going down the tube, of course. Despite we didn't have a rich enough food content, so unfortunately it had to be put down. But
tell me about Midwinter's Day.
Oh, Midwinter's Day. Well, we had a very nice party. We all dressed up. When I look at the picture, so, you know, we're all wearing ties and things like that, which maybe sounds, now looks rather ridiculous, but it seemed to be the thing to do, dress up anyway.
You being a non-drinker, could you get involved?
Well, I didn't drink, and I was very popular as a result. All my my allowance went to everybody else. You know? But we had the party, which went on well into the night. And I remember having to go around retrieving bodies from the snow outside the house.
You know? Human bodies?
Yeah, human bodies. Make sure that they didn't end up there, you know. People dozing off with glasses in their hands and that sort of thing, you know. But we all survived, which was great. In fact, looking back, I'm amazed that we had very little conflict. George, the diesel mechanic, who came from Wootton under Edge in Gloucestershire, and George used to say, "I'm having a black," and George would then retire to the diesel mechanic. He mightn't come out for days, you know. But aside from that, we didn't, because he was a trade unionist, and very, and of course we all wound him up like mad. So, but he was a nice fellow. I liked George enormously.
Did you live at Tronsberg House at any time?
Yes, that was where. Yes.
Okay.
We had this very nice insignia over the door, you know that.
No, tell me.
Oh, please. Yeah. In fact, I think Robin Sherman, who was the one of the surveyors, actually made it. But it was two whales rampant, you know, standing up like this. Elephant seals rampant, and a crest underneath which said Semper in Excreta. which of course amused everybody except the governor, who turned up and said, "Outrage, take it down."
I was wondering also if there was a painting of an Antarctic map on the wall.
That's right, yeah.
In the dining area.
Yes, and Robin had done that too, yeah.
What was that like?
Well, that was grand, a fun map, and with pointers as to where you saw things. And it had, I remember, Laurie Island, Argy's here. you know, and it was covered up eventually, and then when they were building the new hut, they discovered it and brought it back to the UK and restored it, but they crossed out the RG base, which it's now back at Sydney.
Back at Sydney again. Maybe.
Yes, but I mean, political correctness. I mean, it's ridiculous, you know.
Bearing in mind the quality of the organisation so far, how did they get you out of the Antarctic in the final analysis? How did you get home? How did you get out?
Well, would you believe the actual ship turned up? The Biscoe turned up. And that trip was a non-event. You know, I mean, there was no problem. We didn't have an issue coming home.
But there'd been a previous occasion when you'd actually go out to meet the Biscoe.
Oh, yeah. Well, that was when they were coming. That was a spring arrival. I mean, you know, the new boys in 59, in late November. We had a really heavy ice year. I mean, everywhere was clogged with pack ice as far as you could see. I used to go and do ice obs on the summit of the ice cap, and all you could see, of course, was ice in every direction, you know. And the Biscoe tried to come in for about 5 or 6 days, and I think went off and came back, and eventually held the edge of the ice. At that stage was about 3 miles off from Borish Bay. And we had been demanding the mail, because, I mean, whatever else we wanted was the mail. So they finally decided, yes, we could get the mail. And a pinnace was put over the side. And Woodlouse, as we was called, he was the third officer in those days. Woodhouse was his name, but he came down with us on, and everybody called him Woodlouse, because he was a black. He liked to be a martinet. He was only a third officer, you know. He was well known as Woodlouse, and comes ashore, or comes in this pinnace, and it comes along the ice edge, and the ice is, at this point in time, is about 15 feet thick, and I'm standing there with Ken and the dogs, the huskies, the bitches, as they were called. And we're standing on the ice waiting for the sacks of mail. And he leans over and has an ice axe and starts prodding the ice between us, like, was it safe for him to get ashore? So I said to him, give us the fucking mail. And I got the mail and we turned around and shot off.
It was a 3 mile sledge back to the base, wasn't it?
Yes, yeah. And then the lads, the new boys, started to arrive later that day. And apparently, the message got around that there was some very peculiar people on Sydney.
Including you.
Absolutely. Yes.
You have been back, haven't you, in more
yes,
recent years?
That's
tell,
right.
Tell
yeah.
me very briefly, tell me about
okay.
that.
Okay. I was back in 2006 in Sydney. I'd been back four times down south four times this decade, but I only got into Sydney once. And it was such a contrast. It was unbelievable. For those who will know Sydney, there's a Bernston Point, which is just above where the huts are still. In fact, but it overlooks the strait between Coronation and Sydney itself. And it was a place I used to go for rest and recreation. You walked up, it's only a couple of hundred metres, and sit on a rock and look out at what was happening, the ice, the icebergs, the penguins, whatever, you know. So I spent a lot of time there, and I was... So I went up and I said... I could see the indentation of my posterior on this rock. So that must be the one that I, you know. And I looked across at Coronation, which is a beautiful, massive, beautiful island, 90 miles long sort of thing, and covered in ice. Two big glaciers pointing out, the Sunshine Glacier and the Laws Glacier, called after Dick. Protruding at you, you know, They were always present. I said, where in God's name? They had disappeared. Whereas you had a nunatak, you know, just appearing above the ice, the tops of the mountains. Now, all the flanks of these mountains were just scattered with snow. There was hardly a piece of ice to be seen. It was like somebody punched me in the gut. I mean, I got, jeez, I mean, you know, I was absolutely shocked. It was because I had been so used to this. The scene was imprinted on my mind. You know, I can still see it, in fact. And suddenly, the new thing, wow. And of course, the new map of Sydney shows that the ice cap has declined by a third at least. In fact, they've had to redo the geology as a result. You know.
Did you say you've been back four times in this century,
mm-hmm.
since 2000? I think I was with you on 2000.
That's right.
Marguerite Bay, 2000. Yeah. So why do you go back so often? Is it something in your blood? You can't.
Yes, that I would go back every year if I had the opportunity. No, it's a lot of it is nostalgia, but I mean, it is such an unbelievably beautiful place, and I have such good memories of it. You know, in a sense, I grew up there, because I mean, I left Ireland as a very naive 21-year-old. You know,
turned the boy into a man, did it?
Well, I'm not sure about that, but. We made some progress, shall we say, in that direction.
It's been a real treat. Thank you, Fergus.
Not at all. Thank you.